From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we discuss Governor Evers' proposed changes to Wisconsin's marijuana laws and how statewide uniformity would provide more clarity.
There's a lot of murkiness, and there is a lack of standardization. And so that's what makes this, in many respects, a very complicated discussion.
Later, how one Wisconsin woman helped break the gender barrier in broadcast news more than 50 years ago.
So then they said, well, we're not going to fire you. You can stay. But you're going to have to be the receptionist in the front of the building.
We'll explore whether you should try to sell your home as a fixer-upper or fix it up first.
It's an unusual market where a lot of the people looking to purchase really are hoping to have those fixes done before they get there. So it's the sellers that kind of need to look at what do we need to do to get the house sellable.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For years, Wisconsin's laws regulating marijuana possession have been a patchwork of municipal ordinances. Now, Governor Tony Evers is hoping to change that.
In his first budget proposal, Governor Evers has proposed a statewide policy decriminalizing marijuana and legalizing its use for medical purposes. Still, while Evers presents a clear path forward, there remains a lot of confusion over what his proposal would mean for Wisconsinites.
Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which just released a report analyzing the governor's proposal. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio and starts by explaining how the proposed changes would impact the state.
Two major ways, Joy. The first is to have a full-fledged legal medicinal marijuana program. So to the extent that individuals with certain health conditions, upon advice of their doctor, want to use marijuana as a treatment or as a pain reliever or whatever the therapeutic medicinal purpose is, they would be able to register with the state of Wisconsin and would be able to purchase and use marijuana legally. And the added element to that is that in order for them to do that, you also have to set up a regulated market so that there's a place to actually go to purchase the marijuana. So there are a bunch of provisions in the budget bill that sort of spell out exactly the way that would happen, which takes us beyond, I think, the conceptual stage that we've been in. We've had lots of discussion in the state about the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana, either for medicinal or for recreational purposes. This really establishes a solid framework that could be a jumping off point, could be adopted into law, whichever the legislature wants to do. So that's the first point. The second is that there's a provision in there to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. And so that would be something new and different as well.
Now, there has been decriminalization of marijuana, it seems, in some municipalities. What are the laws right now? What do they look like in the state of Wisconsin?
So there's a lot of murkiness, and there is a lack of standardization. And so that's what makes this, in many respects, a very complicated discussion. But let me see if I can summarize it briefly. Let's start with the fact that we're talking about small amounts, and the definition of small amount is 25 grams or less. And if you're trying to visualize that, it's about the amount of marijuana that could fit into a sandwich bag. So, you know, there hasn't been a lot of discussion, and the state law is pretty clear that for over 25 grams, you're not allowed to possess, and you can run afoul of state law if you do so. For those smaller amounts, state law has provided to municipalities the opportunity to sort of lay out their own framework, to determine how big a law enforcement priority it is for them, and to determine what the penalty would be in terms of possessing small amounts. And so in many municipalities across the state, possessing a small amount of under 25 grams or less is a violation of a municipal ordinance. And if it's a violation of a municipal ordinance, it means that typically there would be no criminal charge involved. It would be akin to a parking ticket where there's a fine. If you fail to pay the fine, then you can get into bigger trouble. And there are instances of people serving jail time because they haven't been able to pay the fine. And then that's the other rub. How big should the fine be? So if the fine associated with possession of a small amount is a large amount, then there is certainly the potential that more people could serve jail time because they can't afford to pay it. In the city of Milwaukee recently, the fine was reduced to a range of $1 to $50. And so that's a change that several municipalities have made across the state. But again, it's a patchwork, and that's why there's some complexity here. And so whether you agree or disagree with specifically the way the governor is proposing that marijuana be decriminalized, there certainly is some merit in the notion of having sort of a standard state approach so that whether you are caught possessing in Shorewood versus Milwaukee, there's not going to be a difference.
Well, it seems like there's a big difference in some cases, a dollar in Milwaukee, but then $500 in Green Bay.
Yes. And so that's the point, is that we do see different policies in different places. And, you know, I think I may have misspoke on Milwaukee. I'm just looking at my notes here, but I think the minimum actually may be $50 and not a dollar in Milwaukee. It is. So, but still, it was lowered substantially from what it used to be. It was several hundred dollars.
Yeah. So, you know, you talked about the licensing and the kind of framework that he lays out in his budget proposal. And inside of that proposal, Governor Evers is claiming that licensing and taxes would lead to an estimated $2.4 million in revenue over the next 2 years. Have you looked into the veracity of that estimate?
We have not had the time or opportunity yet to independently verify that, but the Legislative Fiscal Bureau has, and that number is actually coming from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. Now, anyone would admit it's laden with assumptions because at this point in time when you're introducing a new program, it's hard to predict just how many people are going to utilize it. My guess is that that's a low number because it would take time to ramp up that demand and to qualify sufficient numbers of people. So it sounds like a small revenue amount, but again, that's the amount that is attributed to the legal medicinal program. I think a very important point for your listeners is a point we make with regard to the decriminalization proposal. So where Governor Evers' proposal is unique on that side among other states that have decriminalized but have not yet legalized adult usage is that what decriminalization typically means is you're eliminating the potential for criminal offense, and so jail time and having a criminal record, but there's still a penalty. There's still a fine associated with it. Per the governor's proposal, there'd be no fine. So if you are caught with 25 grams or less, there's no penalty. So that would certainly put the state on the far end of the decriminalization spectrum, though still not as far advanced in terms of liberalizing policies to those that have fully legalized for adult recreational usage. But when we get back to your revenue question, a question could be asked. If you're going to essentially go that far toward legalization, why not have that final step, have legalized markets, allow the state to actually put a tax on marijuana usage for recreational purposes as it is doing for medicinal purposes, in which case those revenue numbers would be far more substantial than $2.4 million per year.
And it's something that's happening in states all around Wisconsin, it seems like, right now. Michigan, of course, being the prime example. But Illinois is also considering legislation right now to make recreational marijuana legal. And they have had legal medicinal marijuana for quite a long time.
Correct. And so, again, we are very pointedly not taking sides in this debate, but we feel that this is something that has to be seriously and thoughtfully considered by the legislature. You don't want to enact policy just because your neighbors are doing it. That said, to the extent that increasingly Wisconsin is surrounded by states that not only have legalized for medicinal purposes, which Illinois and Minnesota have, or for recreational purposes, which Michigan has, but if everybody goes to the full legalization, you at least have to ask the question, what does that mean for Wisconsin? What does that mean in terms of Wisconsin residents crossing state lines to access the legal market, potentially using in those states, and then driving back? Is that something we at least have to be concerned about and step up law enforcement along the borders? In terms of the economics, it's not just the notion that potentially we would have Wisconsin residents paying a premium to purchase marijuana in other states, and those states benefit from the tax purposes. But there's also, if you're going to go across a state line because you want to access the legal marijuana market, does that mean that you're shopping across the state line, that you're going to Taco Bell across the state line, or frequenting bars across the state line? And again, that's not a reason, if you're sufficiently concerned about the public health and public safety impacts, to do what your neighbors are doing, but it at least has to enter into the conversation.
Well, in your study notes that federal federal law still prohibits marijuana use and considers it a Schedule I drug. However, unlikely, if legislators did pass these proposals, you know, what would that mean for Wisconsin businesses? And, you know, since we are surrounded by states that are passing recreational marijuana laws, what would it mean for Wisconsinites who are going over state lines?
Well, it's still the, you know, the million-dollar question here, because we were on a path, and it started in California in 1996, and they were the first state to adopt a legal medical marijuana program. Increasingly, we have, of course, seen states fully legalized. There are now 10. That is a contradiction with federal law, without question. Under the Obama administration, a strong signal was sent by the Justice Department that we're going to leave it up to states to determine where their law enforcement priorities are, and our priority is not to enforce these laws. We had former Attorney General Sessions sort of reverse that statement. We now have a new Attorney General who hasn't said anything yet, and so there's a lot of uncertainty. So if the working assumption still is that states do have the ability to carve out to some extent their own policies here, then I think Wisconsin could move forward. But as we point out in the report, one of the big issues that has yet to be resolved is the banking issue. So we still do not have a situation here where a legalized marijuana industry can bank as any other legalized industry can, because banks do not want to deal with this industry because they would run afoul of federal law.
So there's been a lot of backlash to this proposal, specifically from legislators. What are legislators saying about it? They've taken issue certainly with decriminalization, but there are also many legislators that seem to think any kind of marijuana legislation that would allow medicinal marijuana as well, that shouldn't pass either.
Yep. Well, there's there's obviously some passion on both sides of this issue. There are those who feel that marijuana is a dangerous drug, that even if one subscribes to the notion that adults should be able to make decisions for themselves and that using marijuana is no worse than using alcohol, there's a concern about the impact if it's legalized in terms of the ability of adolescents to access marijuana. So there are lots of questions out there. The good news is that as more and more states are traveling down this path, there's more and more data and more firsthand information. Now, sorting through that is difficult because there are interests on both sides that quite simply have the ability to cherry pick different pieces of data and make the cases they want. But again, one of the things that we are suggesting here is that there is now an increasing body of knowledge. And if this state wants to get serious about its consideration, there's a way to go about this. And so I think one of the key questions raised here is the appropriate, is it a good way to go about it to do what the governor's proposing? Let's start with medical. Let's start with decriminalization to get rid of that patchwork. Let's see how that works out. And then let's see if that provides us with the appropriate path to move toward full-scale legalization. So that's a case that certainly could be made. On the other hand, a case could be made that he's going too far too fast, given, as I said before, that we really would be at the far end of the decriminalization spectrum and as close to full legalization as any state that has not yet fully legalized.
Yeah. Well, Rob Henkin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me.
Thank you.
Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which just released its report titled A Clear-Headed Look at Marijuana Policy. He spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find a link to the report at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now, and then we'll meet a woman who helped pave the way for generations of female journalists that came along after her. A conversation with Marianne Bendel when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you look at the list of producers and show hosts at WUWM, with just a couple of exceptions, it is nearly all female. And while the demographic breakdown varies from newsroom to newsroom, women do make up a large percentage of journalists working in the broadcast industry today.
That was most certainly not the case when Marianne Bendel was coming out of Marquette University trying to break into broadcast journalism. It was the late 1950s, and Bendel met with a great deal of opposition as she tried to make her way in the journalism world.
But persistence paid off, and Bendel eventually went on to a storied career that lasted decades and included time working at CBS, Entertainment Tonight, and USA Today. Spendell was back in Milwaukee to receive a National Alumni Award from her alma mater over the weekend, and she stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk about her career. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So do you think of yourself as a trailblazer?
I didn't at the time. I was just trying to find work. When I got out of Marquette, I was working for a CBS U station in Milwaukee, and I got a job as like a secretary to the production manager, which only because it was right next to the newsroom, and I was in the newsroom looking at that time a wire all the time, and they said, "No, Marianne, get out of here. We are never going to hire you as a reporter, so don't come in here." Well, I continued to go in there, and so then they said, "Well, we're not going to fire you. You can stay, but you're going to have to be the receptionist in the front of the building to keep you away from the newsroom." So I immediately quit and went to Savannah, Georgia, and started working and not doing. I was just doing television commercials and teaching and stuff there. But it wasn't until I got to Los Angeles that I was able to get an actual job in radio.
Why do you think it was that it was okay for women to do things like commercials and other aspects of the business, but not be involved in journalism?
I think it was just the male set at that time of, you know, like I was offered Romper Room. I could have done that. I was offered a cooking show. I don't know how to cook. I mean, of course, those things I would have failed at. I think it was a set. This Pauline Fredericks I interviewed once, and she was told women don't have good voices for news. And so I think a lot of it was just the mindset of the times, you know.
I think you've said in interviews before that you always wanted to be a journalist.
Yes.
even before you got to Marquette, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What was the power of journalism you saw when you were young that made you decide from the beginning that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I wanted to see the world. I've been to all seven continents. So when I was a little girl growing up in rural Wisconsin, I would have a geography book in front of me, and I'd go, shut my eyes and say, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, where am I going today? And point to a country. And I'd say, okay, I'll go there. One day I pointed to Antarctica, and I said, I will go there. I have no idea. You know, to go to Antarctica, even today, unless you go with a research ship, or you go with the U.S. government, you have a minder at McMurdo, you can't go there. So I got to go there for 3 months. That was the highlight of my career, I think.
So you got to Marquette's.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any encouragement from the faculty there as a woman going into this business?
No.
At the same time, obviously, they let you get the degree.
Well, you know, I got a degree in speech, not journalism, but it was radio, TV, film major. And they had a thing called Radio Workshop, which I was in, and they would take like half-hour shows and put them on stations in Milwaukee. So, you know, because we didn't have a separate radio studio, but I did that. So I was able to get some experience that way. But no, they did not encourage at all.
The faculty was just like the people in the industry. They thought that this was no profession for a woman.
Right. Yeah.
So what did it eventually take? What was the opportunity that you finally got? I know you ended up on as a producer on Firing Line. How did you get that job?
I applied for it. There were 75 people that applied. Today, there'd be 7,500. and they picked me. I don't know why, but they did. And so I produced that show for a number of years, and then went on to other things. You know.
For people that aren't familiar with that show, it's a famous name. But what was that show like? What would people tune in for?
It was news information. And you know, they had a news reporter. They had, and I would basically book people that I thought would be interesting interviews. You know,
and so as someone who had not gotten a job in journalism to that point, was it instructive in terms of like learning to do interviews yourself?
Oh yes, I mean I listened to everybody. I think people were doing. I did have a job between my junior and senior year of college. I worked for a radio station. I signed it on and signed it off in Wausau, Wisconsin. It was owned by Congressman Okonski. So I had that job in the summer. But that was just a summer job, you know, and that at least gave me experience of being on air on an actual station. But, Firing Line was a big help.
Well, and so what were the doors that job opened for you?
I got a chance to do some things at CBS. I did a lot of pilots, you know, things like that. It was mostly segment producing kind of stuff. And I also, you know, Entertainment Tonight, I was a segment producer and traveled all over the country for that. So it was sort of a mishmash of catch 22 as far as what happened, you know, how I got in, how I actually got. Actually, the biggest break that I had was rather late in my career. USA Today, Newhouse said he was going to hire one half women and minorities because he had grown up as the son of a working mother, and he said, "I'm going to give women a chance." So
this is like the late 1970s, beginning of 1980s.
No, right? It was like in the early 80s. Yeah. I think it started in 81 or 82, okay. Along in there. And I was sort of like being Barbara Walters in print. I got a chance to interview movers and shakers of the world, a half-page interview, Q&A only. And I interviewed everybody from Benjamin Netanyahu twice to Zsa Gabor to Jimmy Stewart to presidents of countries, you know, just anybody who was in the news, you know.
Well, and at that point, you had been in the field for, probably 15 years?
Yeah, yeah.
What was it? How do you think your interview style, your writing style, your ability to get the answers that would interest people, how did that evolve?
My open Midwestern face is what I think people just trusted me, you know?
As someone who interviews people for a living, what were the kinds of interviews that you were the most comfortable doing?
People who made a difference in the world. I mean, I had a very hard time getting through an interview I did with Jonas Salk. It took me 2 years to get this interview. He hated the press. He hated reporters.
Jonas Salk, for people who don't know, the man who invented the polio vaccine.
Yeah, made sure that our kids didn't get polio. And I had a hard time getting through the interview because I kept thinking, because of you, my daughter never got polio. So those kind of people. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu, I've had a relationship. I could probably call him up and interview him tomorrow because I've interviewed him several times. First time I interviewed him, he was the ambassador to the UN. And I went away from that interview saying, this man's going to be premier of Israel someday. And everybody at the paper said, oh, come on. I said, no. He's a comer. It's going to happen. And, of course, look what's happened.
Well, I was going to say, at that point, you probably would have had no idea that, you know, he would still be leading the country in 2019.
No, he's the ultimate politician. He really is.
What are the kinds of interviews you were least comfortable doing?
Well, there was one I did with Zsa Gabor that was really uncomfortable. I mean, it's on the interview that I did with Ed Marquette. It was really kind of interesting. I sat like further away than you are now, across the room from her, because she didn't want me to see her face work. And I'm sitting here, and on this side and on this side of me are two attack German shepherds. I'm totally frightened of German shepherds. And they're sitting there going, and then in the hallway, his husband is walking back and forth with tall boots on a slate floor going, chop, chop, chop. I was just terrified. I was afraid one of those dogs was going to just bite me.
Usually attack dogs are a metaphor in a case like
this. Yeah, but these are real, you know. And I don't know why she had them sitting on either side of me. I don't know what she thought I was going to do. But that was probably the worst. And one of the most fun interviews I did was Chuck Yeager. Just an incredible man.
What made that so much fun?
Well, I interviewed him as a way to get the Medal of Honor or from, I think it was Reagan. I don't know. But I interviewed him in the airport, and I was looking at my watch, and I was thinking, oh, my God, he's late. And all of a sudden I hear, ma'am, you could set me your watch by me. In other words, I'm going to be there when I said I'm going to be there. And he's just a very fascinating man.
And I guess if anybody would be prompt, it would be a test pilot.
Oh, yeah. He was, He's just an incredible man. I really liked him. And I interviewed just a lot of really interesting people, you know.
You mentioned your trip to Antarctica, mm-hmm. and that was as part of a time that you were on board a Greenpeace ship, right?
Yes. And I learned from there, never live with your source. Because I would do things and they wouldn't talk to me for a couple of days because I would tell the truth of what was going on. They expected me to be part of their team. I was not. There was a reporter there also from the Guardian, London Guardian. And so I did stuff for USA Today and the Gannett News Service. And it was an incredible experience. I'm so glad I did it. I wouldn't do it again at this point in my life. But then I guess what really got me was the silence of that continent. It is totally silent. And I felt it kept saying to us, or me, get out of here. We don't want you here. And they do everything. It does everything possible, from falling in an ice crevice to freezing to death, to keep you out of there. You know.
There are not a lot of silent places left in this world.
No, that's the only the most silent place I've ever been, where there is nothing, no sound at all. Yeah.
When you think of reporting trips like that, and you think of all the people that you have interviewed over the years and stories you have done over the years, and then you look at journalism today, what do you think of the way that, this profession carries out its mission in 2019?
It's very tough. I mean, how do you get at the truth? It was Bed Bradley said, the truth is everything. I don't care what side you're looking at. If you're looking at the Democrats, you're looking at the Republicans, you're looking at senators, congressmen, the president. How do you find out the truth? I mean, you must run into that every day trying to find out, is he telling me the truth or is he blue skying me, you know? And I think that's the biggest thing that young journalists starting out today are going to have to face. How do you get to the truth?
You're back as we're having this conversation. You're getting a Lifetime Achievement Award from your alma mater, Marquette.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I gather you've had some fair amount of contact with Marquette over the years.
Yes.
What lessons would you hope journalism students who are coming out of Marquette today could take from your career?
From my career, I know that the Jesuits taught me to think logically and think before I talk. And Father Huger was my history professor, and he said, remember, Marianne, before you do anything, say to yourself, who would know? I would know. And I've used that in my journalism. I tell journalism students that all the time. Look to yourself first, and if you're being uncomfortable doing what you're going to do, don't do it, you know? But most people don't even think that way anymore. But I don't know it's really tough to give advice to young people starting the business. It's really hard today. You know?
Well, it's so different.
Yes, it's so different. You know, it's digital journalism, as you know. You know, Marquette has got some of the best equipment. They've got not one but two robotic cameras that cost about $350,000 a piece. TMJ has one. They have two. But their kids are learning state-of-the-art journalism, where they can go out of that journalism department and walk right into a studio, you know, and that's good.
It's amazing to think about a camera that's worth more than a house.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It really is.
It's interesting to think about what your professors, when you were at Marquette, who were completely discouraging when it came to whether you could go into this field. I wonder what they would think of the field and your career now.
Well, the ones who encouraged me were, as I call them, the rebels of the church, the Jesuits. They did encourage me. They just said, go for whatever dream you have. The lay professors, no. But a lot of the Jesuits encouraged me to go in and, hey, give it a try, you know?
This is the question. I get this question a lot, honestly, but I'm curious to hear your answer to it. Is there one person or a group of people out there that you wish you had a chance to interview that you haven't yet?
Well, I had an interview scheduled with Margaret Thatcher, but I canceled it because USA Today wouldn't pay for me to come in, because the week before I'd done the president of Finland, and they said, we'll have somebody else do it. And I said, no. And I called up her people and canceled it, and they never did that to me again. But, I mean, that's what I would have liked to have interviewed.
Well, Marianne Bendel, I am glad to say that I've now interviewed you.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed every bit of it.
And I hope we'll have a chance to chat again.
For sure. Okay. Thank you.
Marianne Bendel's decades in journalism included work for USA Today, Entertainment Tonight, and CBS. She was in Milwaukee last weekend to receive an alumni award from her alma mater, Marquette University. You can see pictures of her from her career at a slideshow at WUWM.com.
They are not quite pioneers in the same way as Marianne Bendel, but a group of Milwaukee women is making a difference in one pop culture pastime. We will meet them and find out what that pastime is when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. 50 years ago this month, The Who made rock and roll history with its rock opera, Tommy, introducing a deaf, dumb, and blind kid who would become the world's most famous pinball player ever.
Electronic video games now dominate the gaming world, but a group of Milwaukee women is helping keep pinball alive. Milwaukee writer and independent producer Barbara Miner introduces us to some of the flipper and bumper specialists.
On the first Thursday of the month, the Ladies Pinball League gathers at Bremen Cafe in River West, a Milwaukee neighborhood whose DIY, analog-friendly culture fits well with pinball. Anywhere from 5 to 10 women get together with the range of ages and experience, such as Alice.
I am 40 years old. The first time I ever played pinball, I was a wee child back in the early days of arcade land. And the pinball was the main game that I could actually get at because the boys were not constantly monopolizing it.
And Liz, a 20-something millennial.
This is my first time here. I've never, ever played pinball on a pinball machine.
Liz is somewhat scared, but Alice has classic advice.
Keep eye on the ball, keep eye on the ball.
The league has been around about 6 years, most of that time led by Jess Anderson. A pinball aficionado, she and her husband even have a few machines in their basement.
I'm just old enough to remember going to places like Woolworth's or even like Goldman's and sitting in the diner and, you know, there being a pinball machine in a pharmacy or a candy shop.
Most league members aren't crazy about the digital gaming world, including Marissa, a 40 from West Allis.
Everything is dominated by electronic video games. You know, pinballs are like old school.
I'm out.
We play pretty simple here. We try and keep it pretty, like, we play, we get a few points if you win at the end of the night, and then we have prizes. For a while we had some beer prizes, but now we just give away candy.
And what about Tommy, the most famous pinball player ever, immortalized in the rock opera by The Who?
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
Yeah, well, we couldn't have a conversation about pinball without talking about Tommy, right? You'll find that pinball people generally are just like, ugh. But I don't know if you could actually be deaf, dumb, and blind and play pinball. I have yet to actually see that.
Smack that ball. Smack that ball.
Barbara Miner is a journalist and independent producer in Milwaukee. You can see photos of the Ladies Pinball League at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we'll learn about some of the issues surrounding buying or selling a fixer-upper home in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
More of Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you have bought or sold a house recently or just looked around at the forest of for sale signs around town, you know the Milwaukee real estate market is hot right now. Demand is outstripping supply in many parts of town. And so with prices reflecting that phenomenon, there are many buyers who are looking at fixer-uppers, houses that are priced a little lower but could use some improvements to feel more like home.
At the same time, the questions for sellers is, how much work do you put in before you put your home on the market? We're joined in the studio by Ron Klassen, owner of Klassen Remodeling and Design, and by Amy Curler, chair of Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Amy, what is the health of the housing market here in Milwaukee right now?
It is good. We have a very strong market. Houses are moving quickly. One of the things we are looking for is some more inventory. We could actually sell more homes if they were on the market. That is the one thing that's kind of driving the quickness, is that once something comes on the market, the buyers are kind of clamoring all to see it and to put their offers in.
Yeah, I've heard of some houses having offers 10, 20 over asking before anyone even steps foot in the house.
Yep, that can be the case.
Which, yeah, seems kind of insane sometimes. But what is driving this shortage of stock? Is it people who are living here locally already ready to make that investment to buy? Or do we have a bigger population of people coming to live and inhabit Milwaukee?
We have a little bit of both. We do have some of the millennials starting to hit the market. They're kind of achieving their first jobs and earning more income, so they're ready to purchase. We do have the typical upsizing and downsizing. So we have a lot of buyers on the market, but we have a few less sellers ready to go because they're kind of considering, well, where do I go next? And so they have that hesitation before they're putting the home on the market.
And with such a short supply, obviously there's been a lot of price inflation. So what would you say is a good median number of what some houses are going for? And if you want to list a couple neighborhoods even to kind of show that it's a big range, I suppose.
It is. It's a really big range. So it would be hard to pinpoint because it is home by home. But most houses, if they're in good condition, are selling at asking or over. And condition does play into it. And I think some of the things we're going to be talking about today, that buyers really are looking for the house ready to move in. They've been watching your HGTV and love all of those updates, and they'd really prefer for them to be done when they move in.
Right. And that's a perfect segue into one of my questions. But do you find that people, don't have a complete or realistic picture of what it will take to not only just make a home purchase, but to buy a home that needs work to be done when we have so many shows showing the simple, easy ways to remodel your home all within 30 minutes? How has this influenced people's expectations or maybe even caused some negative outcomes for them?
Yeah, I will turn some of that over to Ron, but it is absolutely true that there is an expectation on the buying end that it looks good. Or if they're going to jump into it, doing it themselves, they I think, sometimes overestimate their ability.
Yeah, and the cost factor. I think that there's times when those things are kind of downplayed on those shows, and it does lead to some unrealistic expectations as to what that dream kitchen or that gorgeous, spa-like bathroom is going to cost them. And yeah, it can be a real sticker shock issue if they find out too late. We try to help them understand the reality of the situation before they get too far into that process, if we can. And we can point them to, there's actually a document available online from Remodeling Magazine called the Cost Versus Value Report that you can download for the Milwaukee region, and it'll tell you what the average expenditure was last year for various projects, and it'll tell you what was involved in those. And sometimes we'll send them to that and say, hey, you might want to just scope through this a little bit first before you get too far into this. We just hate to see people get themselves too deep in.
Right, you rip it down to the studs and you can't go any further.
Right. Yeah, budget's gone and you don't have a sink left,
Right. So, what are you looking for if you're walking through something? And what are some warning signs? What are some good signs of, like, yes, this has potential? I mean, every project is never hassle-free. It's never as straightforward as people would like to think they will be, unless you're putting a coat of paint on a wall. I'd say that's the most straightforward project you're going to have.
Most of the time.
Yeah, so in your experience and what you've learned to spot, what are some things that buyers should be looking at?
Well, I think the big thing, there's a number of realtors in the area, and if you know one that you trust, we suggest that they talk to them. But someone like Amy is very knowledgeable and very honest about, yes, you could buy this house, but if you're going to redo this kitchen, you're probably going to need to speak to someone like us or one of the other remodelers in town. And you're probably going to be a little surprised at what it might cost you to do that. And you could try to take it on yourself, but then there's some issues, do you really have the time? Do you have the capability? Those kind of issues.
It's true. And the Realtors Association actually does have some statistics and surveys about what remodels get the most money in return, mm-hmm. and also which create the most value for a new buyer or for themselves. For themselves, we call it the Joy Report. So, for instance, on the interior projects, a complete kitchen renovation is very high on the list. It's a 10 on a 10 for a Joy score for people that are living in it now. But it's also very high on a new buyer looking for this if they're going to sell the house. And according to our statistics, you would get 62% back out of what you put into that remodel. So that one really is kind of high on the scores for interior projects.
Mm-hmm. What are some other areas that are quick, main, well, not necessarily easy fixes, but main things that sellers and buyers are looking to accomplish?
Yep. The kitchen upgrades or full renovations are huge. Another thing that's pretty interesting and easy is if you have a hardwood floor now, refinishing a hardwood floor is really high on the score of what buyers are looking for. And it also adds a lot of value. You're looking at 91% return on investment for that.
Now, Ron, I imagine when you and your company come in to start working on a project, you probably come across some of the worst easy fixes or repairs that previous owners have done. What are some examples of that?
We see a lot of, especially in older homes, we see a lot of cases where they've painted the cabinets and, you know, they're not aware necessarily of the preparation techniques it takes to get paint to stick to cabinets. And so the paint is in trouble and it's kind of not very attractive. So then the question is what's the best fix for that? You know, the proper prep and the stripping and all that sort of jazz, or would it be better to just, you know, bite the bullet and replace the cabinets perhaps, you know? But again, I keep going back to this, that we would want to have a realtor involved to say, okay, in this neighborhood, yes, that would definitely pay for itself, or no, right now you're not going to get your money back for 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it might be. And then, so then we'd be trying to help the client understand that, or yeah, prospective client, that not, you maybe not might want to go this way.
I think that's really true, because if you're looking in a neighborhood that you want to purchase and remodel a house, or you're in your house and you want to remodel it to stay, you don't want to be the most expensive house on the block. So, you know, if no one else in that neighborhood has granite or, you know, the really nice fancy garage door, hardwood, you kind of have to suit the neighborhood as well, or you're not going to get the return on your investment back out.
Well, and one thing that could be difficult, kind of on the opposite spectrum, we have a lot of great old housing stock here, mm-hmm. and sometimes people will come in and gut it and make it look totally modern on the inside when buyers maybe are looking for that classic bungalow look, or they want the stained hardwood. They don't want painted over white with gray walls, you know. Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's some reversal projects, so to speak?
Yes, yeah, and it's a gentle blend, because a lot of people that want those beautiful old homes want to keep some of that integrity and have the modern twist. So mm-hmm. that is where a Ron would come in to say, okay, this is what would make sense, and in cost-wise and in aesthetics.
We see a lot of 60s and 70s reversals.
Well, and Ron, often we see reports about the number of construction jobs that can fluctuate as the economy does well or does poorly. Do you find that it impacts the remodeling industry in the same way?
Oh, absolutely. New home building is at one of its lowest paces in a number of years because so many tradespeople left the industry after the big recession, and they're not coming back. And so we're all fighting for a much smaller trade labor pool, and that's making it a challenge to complete, whether it's a remodeling project or build a new home or whatever. It's really been a latch spot for us.
Mm-hmm.
If I might, shameless plug for kids getting into the trades. Kids today are graduating from college with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. And they might not even be able to get a job in the field that they, quote unquote, trained for. Whereas kids that go into trade schools are, you know, they're walking out of school without any debt, and they're able to step into a $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 a year job just like that. So just a little plug for that. Encouraging people that hey, it's a great field.
Well, and it does play into the whole, not necessarily dilemma, but why people are going into fixer-uppers in the mm-hmm. first place, because money is an option, right? Mm-hmm. But whether people think they're handy or are actually handy is another factor. But when a project goes awry, they do need to call on tradespeople. And if there is a shortage of tradesmen or qualified tradesmen in the area, how does that impact the pricing of fixes and repairs and remodeling.
It has caused the labor rate to rise somewhat. It hasn't been horrific. It's not like people have doubled or tripled their rates. But they know that they could charge a little more, and they were suffering from a little wage deflation because of the price pressures during the recession, which lasted so long. So there is a little bit of that. The big thing is the timing. So if somebody is looking at remodeling a kitchen before they sell it because they can get more than if the realtor looks at it and says, you'll get more than you put in, and we've actually seen that happen, they're going to wait 6 weeks for qualified carpenters to come and replace the cabinetry. So that's the reality today, and it's kind of tough to deal with sometimes.
Right. And I imagine there's a big mix of, you know, people want to be getting housing stock. There's a lot of people looking for houses. And then there's a lot of sellers who think, okay, it's the right time to sell, but then they make all these changes. And don't you get that regret? Like, yeah. Oh, it's actually really nice in here now. I want to live here.
They do say that. They say their house looks the best right before they're about to sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a shame. And what do you guys find that are some fixes that are relatively simple and affordable but can give homeowners or sellers the best return of investment? I imagine like plumbing and electrical, those are obvious like very big projects that can run the gamut of cost and run into obstructions. But what are some good like relatively easy cosmetic repairs that even someone who feels they're not very experienced or handy,
yes,
if they have the time, can accomplish this?
Yeah, so we touched on it earlier. The biggest number one thing is paint. Just getting a good clean coat of paint on the walls brightens and freshens everything up. Declutter. Everybody can do that. You know, just declutter. It really makes a big difference. You know, open up the closets. Very simple, inexpensive things like that. Changing out a front door is really big.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a huge difference on your drive-by appearance and also for sound and quality inside the house. Those are a few things. Front lawn, front landscaping, those are easy fixes and not too expensive.
Garage doors, actually, are also on that list. You mentioned electrical and plumbing. There's so many cool things out today now because of LED lighting. You can install under cabinet lighting and get it powered up without as much difficulty as you'd had to before. They now make a device that looks like a recessed can light that fits into the drywall of a ceiling, and it doesn't take very long to install. You don't have to take any ceiling down. You don't have to, you know, for a qualified electrician. So that is not a major investment. And one of the things we see in older kitchens is the lighting is pathetic. There was one light in the middle of the room and one light over the sink, and that's all you had. So to add a few of these, you know, pseudo-recessed LED fixtures is not an expensive thing, but it really brightens up a space. And plumbing, you can, you know, changing out some faucets, especially if they're leaking or the finish is degraded or anything like that, that's not an expensive proposition, but it can make the difference in a kitchen.
In the kitchen, too, door pulls, the hardware on the cabinets, changing that out.
So relatively straightforward and expensive things, you know, definitely not going to run the same bill as a whole kitchen demolish project or anything like that.
Absolutely.
Amy, earlier you mentioned that there's a lot of groups competing for the same market right now. We have millennials looking to buy their first home. We have baby boomers looking to downsize into the similar size home. Do you find that both parties or anyone, a good amount of buyers regardless, are motivated and knowledgeable enough to take on these kinds of projects, whether, you know, they are looking to downsize and just want to make a space more comfortable for their foreseeable future home or even if it's a first home?
So motivated, yes. Knowledgeable, maybe not as much. Again, it's an unusual market where a lot of the people looking to purchase really are hoping to have those fixes done before they get there. So it's the sellers that kind of need to look at what do we need to do to get the house sellable. So then are they qualified and motivated? Usually they are motivated because they want to move the house. And of course, on the internet, there's lots of videos of how to. So they can get some instruction on, you know, the simple projects. Definitely would recommend a professional if they're looking at the big ones. Because that is another thing that we as realtors can tell. When we walk into a house, we can tell if it's not been done professionally. There are some telltale signs.
What are some examples of that?
Cabinets that aren't secured or wobbly or uneven. plumbing that's not secure, might have leaks or drips. You can tell it's a new faucet, but it's not working properly. Yeah, just different things that can kind of point out that this was a DIY.
Now, many people are choosing fixer-uppers nowadays because of cost restrictions. But what other arguments would you two make to encourage making this investment?
It's the American dream. So it is the best investment for your money, but it's also about quality of life. If you're living in a neighborhood with other families and people tend to take care of them better than, for instance, a rental. So your lifestyle is better in a neighborhood, in a family home or first-time home. It's quality of life.
On the other side of it, if you renovate, you get to make it your own. You get to make it the way you want it. And again, realtors and others are oftentimes called in to make sure that making it your own doesn't make it unsaleable to anybody else. But on the other side, we have a lot of seniors that are looking to either get out of a, you know, two-story colonial that they can't maintain or they can't do the stairs so much anymore, and they're trying to get into ranch homes and things like that. So there are some simple things that they can do. Again, back to lighting is big and all that sort of jazz. But the key there, though, is to understand the need and kind of steer them in the right way and then help them figure out what's the best approach. Is it better to move into a facility or a community where all of the housing is already prepped for them, or renovate the house that they have now to make it livable for them? There's no right answer to that question. Every case is different, but again, I think there's a partnership here that works really well when you have the realtor, the client, and maybe someone like ourselves, depending on the situation, you know, kind of having a conversation about what makes sense here. You know, mm-hmm. The factor of the neighborhood, factor of the family, and then the needs.
Well, Amy Curler and Ron Klassen, I want to thank you both for coming in today and sharing some of your insights.
Thank you, Audrey.
You're quite welcome. It's been great. Mm-hmm.
Amy Curler is chair of the Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors. Ron Klassen is owner of Klassen Remodeling and Design, which is a member of NARI, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. You'll find links to more about buying and selling fixer-upper homes at WUWM.com. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.